information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight we care.
To border
it shows.
On
the law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Some terrorist thing just to get some money out of Congress?
Their arrest was only the beginning.
We are being lied to by
the government. They were innocent. They have no idea what they're up against.
I said it before and I'll say it again. There are money lenders in the temple, my friends. Welcome to Media Monarchy, episode 93. It's September 26, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, your source for news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week, WAMU fails, NWO wins, Paul DeFazio and taxpayers fight. Bush, banksters, bailouts and bribes, protests, vote fraud, and the walls that divide us. I'm glad you're here. It's important. It's September 26th, 2008. It's episode 93 of MediaMonarchy.com.
Mimic you, it's not so hard to make that sound. So watch your back, the Ides of March. Cut your hair like Joan of Arc. Disguise your will, they'll find you out. And when they do, look out. There's money lending inside the temple, that circus tiger's gonna break your heart. Something so wild turned into paper. If I loved you, well, that's my fault. Bitchin' heat, the alpha male. Not something she'd ever tell, except when she got deathly high. Then out it came like summer rain. Washed the cars and everything. Felt clean for just a little while. A telethon. We drunk down. The starving children, they ain't got no mother. There's pink flamingos living in the mall. I'd give a fortune to your infomercial if somebody would just take my call. Take my call. Take my call. Patterns in my mind now moving slow. Sorrow all across the surface rose. Smoothing out the edges of the stone. The lights are out, where'd everybody go? Alone. Erase yourself and you'll be free. Mandela destroyed by the sea. All we are is colored sand. So pay to ride the Ferris wheel. Smile all that you can feel is gratitude for what has been. Cause it did not happen. There's moneylenders inside the temple. That circus tiger's gonna break my heart. Something so wild turned into paper. If you love me, then that's your fault. There's moneylenders inside the temple. This crystal city's gonna fall apart. When all their power turns into vapor. If I miss you, well, that's my fault. That's my fault. That's my fault.
Lenders in the Temple. That's brand new music from Connor Oberst from his new self-titled sort of solo debut, aside from Bright Eyes. And that's the song I should have played last week, where our theme was we must throw the money changers out of the temple. But it's still fitting, because our economy is still falling apart at a rapid rate. But we'll get into that here in just a second. First, let me thank you for joining me here on episode 93 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. It's September 26th, 2008, and coming to you live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time, RevereRadioNetwork.com. Also on KBFR out in Boulder and Ground Zero 87.9 in Atlanta, LPFM style. Thank you. And you can hit me up on MySpace, Dig, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, and Skype with Media Monarchy as your keyword, and iTunes, Radio for All.net, and Archive.org, or where you can get the podcast. Once again, as it's become more of a regular thing, that I've been recording what I'm calling the B-sides to episodes. I think last I looked, I had some 70-plus downloads of the B-side of episode 92. So again, let me thank you. And so you got to subscribe. So if you're only ever listening live on PRA or listening on Revere, there's another show you're missing now, because as everything goes insane, I can't keep up, and it's just me doing MediaMonarchy.com. Although, I sometimes feel like I'm pretty close to soliciting help, so we'll see. JP Morgan bought my bank. WaMu sold in biggest U.S. bank failure. The biggest bank to fail in U.S. history. This from the Associated Press. As the debate over a $700 billion bank bailout, quote-unquote, rages on in Washington, one of the nation's largest banks, Washington Mutual Incorporated, has collapsed under the weight of its enormous bad bets on the mortgage market. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, seized WaMu on Thursday and then sold the thrift's banking assets to JP Morgan Chase for $1.9 billion. And if we jump to the Washington Post, federal regulators last night seized the massive, troubled mortgage lender Washington Mutual in the largest bank failure in U.S. history, then immediately sold much of the company to J.P. Morgan Chase for $1.9 billion in a deal that will create the largest bank in the country. The historic two-step was orchestrated by Sheila Bayer, BAIR, chairman of the FDIC, on terms that preserve Washington Mutual's deposits and avoid what could have been a huge drain on the insurance fund that protects deposits up to $100,000. The fall of Washington Mutual, which was the country's largest savings and loan, expands once again the vast burned-over district at the heart of the financial industry. The federal government has seized mortgage financers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and insurance giant American International Group, AIG. The five largest independent investment banks are closed or have changed their business model. Most of the largest mortgage companies are sold or closed. This is the first time, however, that a large bank funded mostly by deposits has failed during the current crisis. The sale furthers the consolidation of the U.S. financial industry, and that's what it's all about, which is increasingly dominated by a few colossal banks with more than $1 trillion in assets, offering a vast range of services. J.P. Morgan will become the largest, surpassing Bank of America.
As the debate in Washington rages on about how to bail out the nation's economic crisis, another one of the country's largest banks has collapsed. Washington Mutual has gone under, seized by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation on Thursday. The FDIC then turned around and sold WaMu's thrift banking assets to J.P. Morgan Chase for nearly $2 billion.
I'm not going to say that that is not going to happen, but no matter what, WaMu has a really, really impressive severance package, and I think that's going to be carried on even if there is a merger.
Washington Mutual's fall has been widely anticipated. The bank's stock has plummeted 95% of the past year. On Thursday, it closed at only $169 a share. Like many other financial institutions, WaMu fell victim to heavy mortgage-related losses, including the once-booming subprime mortgage business. For WaMu employees, nervousness abounds.
Of course, we're going to have some uncertainties and some questioning about what's going on. Have I been nervous? Sure. I mean, it's just kind of the nature of the whole beast. When a large company gets bought out, you wonder about your job. Our head's going to roll. You just don't know. But we have faith in our bosses and the people upstairs.
Washington Mutual was founded nearly 120 years ago and is by far the largest bank to fail in the country's history. WaMu is J.P. Morgan Chase's second acquisition this year. In March, J.P. Morgan bought the investment bank Bear Stearns. J.P. Morgan Chase is now the second largest bank in the country, only standing behind Bank of America. J.P. Morgan Chase says the acquisition will give it 5,400 branches in 23 states. It plans to close less than 10% of those. Or Larisi, Associated Press.
No final agreement on the financial bailout plan, even in the face of the largest bank failure in U.S. history. CBS 2's Jay Dow, live on the Upper West Side with the overnight developments. Jay, good morning to you.
Well, good morning to you, Maurice, on a very windy morning. Wall Street wondered for several days what would happen to Washington Mutual. Now they know customers will wake up to find out that the bank failed. It's been sold to J.P. Morgan Chase, although branches will open for business this morning, and their deposits are secured.
Washington Mutual, also known as WaMu, is now the property of J.P. Morgan Chase, an historic financial meltdown that easily ranks as the biggest bank failure in U.S. history. Government regulators stepped in last night to seize the ailing institution, which got into big trouble dealing in high-risk mortgages and tried unsuccessfully over the last several days to auction itself off. In the end, regulators were worried that a flat-out WaMu collapse would further cripple the weak market. So they held a secret auction of their own. The winner, J.P. Morgan Chase, which has become the government's go-to player, its knight in shining armor in these troubling times. In March, Chase agreed to buy Bear Stearns as it collapsed, then weeks ago attempted to arrange a bridge loan for failed insurance giant AIG. Now Chase will absorb $31 billion in WaMu losses in exchange for taking over the nation's largest savings and loan at a rock-bottom price of just under $2 billion. Keeping WaMu's failure off taxpayers' plate helps, especially as the Bush administration's proposed Wall Street bailout plan continues to stumble through the Capitol. Negotiations broke off late last night. Democrats say, ironically, the president's own party is now standing in the way of progress.
And at this point, we have no participation in an effort to get a bill passed from the House Republicans.
The core provisions of this plan remain in place. They are tentatively agreed to compensation limits for executives who would seek the government's help, government oversight of this plan, and allowing the government to have ownership stake in the companies that take advantage of this bailout plan. They're going to be back at it today down in Washington to see if they can get this hammered out. We're live on the Upper West Side. Jay Dow, CBS 2 News.
If we click over to Google News and look at some of the latest right now, and this is just 2 hours ago from Bloomberg. WaMu seized by U.S., assets sold to J.P. Morgan in record failure. And also coming from theguardian.co.uk, confidence in U.S. banks nosedives after Washington Mutual collapse, and I believe the stock market is doing horribly at the moment. Some of the other interesting things going on in the news. A clause in the West Virginia laws allows Santa to run. He's one of the 14 people on the ballot for the presidency. One of the 14 write-in candidates for president in West Virginia is Santa Claus. And that's coming from NPR. I'd bookmarked that story. I haven't posted it up yet, but apparently it's gaining traction. We've also got Ron Paul, don't ask for a bailout. And we're going to hear more from him in just a few minutes. One thing to note, and one thing that I said last week, is I don't claim for a second to fully understand how this whole Ponzi scheme, pyramid scheme, all works. But like I said, I do know that the Federal Reserve is neither. It is not federal. It's private banks. They loan us money at interest, and we pay them back, even though Congress has the right to make the money. But the Federal Reserve Act took that. The creature from Jekyll Island. Another interesting way, I think, to think about this is something that Jordan Maxwell turned me on to. It's the way you can sort of equate money with water. And so one of the previous articles says, you know, this is further consolidation. And that's the thing. It's a consolidation because in times of upheaval like this, wealth and money is not destroyed. It's merely transferred and transformed. So money, in a way, real, is like water. So it's not destroyed, it just changes form. And you can also, there's interesting wordplay and semantics with the way that the currency flows between the banks. But if we jump to the next posting, money shit, bailouts, banksters, bread, and circuses. The first one is from thewashingtonnote.com. Bush does 9/11 replay in ask for unprecedented powers and budget. Just after 9/11, George W. Bush went before the nation and made the case that he needed unprecedented authority, budgetary and military, to take on the threats poised at the well-being and safety of the country. Now, with the current economic crisis in the U.S., Bush is yet again asking for unprecedented powers and budget. What happened after 9/11? We saw no-bid contracts given to firms like Halliburton. We saw $9 billion of U.S. taxpayer money go missing through the Coalition Provisional Authority. We saw abuses of power, the expansion of secrecy, and the promulgation of norms that seem to be the very antithesis of what America stands for. A nation's values and its deep DNA are really only knowable and observable during times of crisis, when it's tough to stand up for codes that seem a heavy burden during tough times. We are in a crisis again, and the Bush administration is again asking Americans to forego fundamental values. So, George Bush, in his speech from the White House, succeeded, I think, in scaring Americans that this crisis could be a systemic threat. Bush said, quote, "Our entire economy is in danger," end quote. That's the fear button. He pushed it, and he said the clock was ticking. This seems like a bad episode of 24, as opposed to a good episode of 24. I don't know. I think, have I postulated before that, much like we saw Fox's Lone Gunman spinoff from The X-Files, the pilot episode featuring rogue factions within the military-industrial complex hijacking commercial planes with remote control to crash them into the World Trade Center to kick off the Clash of Civilizations. That episode ran in March 2001, I believe. But the first season of 24, I believe, is about the assassination attempts on the first black president and other, of course, false flag terror events. But if we jump to Raw Replay, we got the Three Stooges meeting at the White House yesterday, all acting like they fucking run something. President Bush met with congressional leaders Barack Obama and John McCain at the White House.
I want to thank the leaders of the House and the Senate for coming. I appreciate our presidential candidates for being here as well. We're in a serious economic crisis in the country, and if we don't pass a piece of legislation, I want to thank the spirit of bipartisan cooperation that's taking place here in Washington. One thing the American people have to know is that all of us around the table take this issue very seriously. And we know we've got to get something done as quickly as possible. And this meeting is an attempt to move the process forward. My hope is that we can reach an agreement very shortly. I want to thank the Secretary of the Treasury for working hard with the members. Thank the members for working long hours like they've been doing to come up with a solution that's bipartisan and that'll solve the problem. Thank you very much.
I'm trying to look here. See, there's John McCain. We're told Barack Obama from my butt Carl is on the opposite end of the table. I just want to run this out, guys. We've got so Danny Hoyer there. That's it. So, take my word for it. Barack Obama was there. Carl Rove right now on the phone with us. You heard a little bit of that, Carl, that you know, they want to get something done shortly. This is important to move on immediately. Both candidates seem to agree. Will this make any difference?
Well, the meeting is evidence that a lot has been done, that these kind of meetings don't come together and Democrats and Republicans don't troop down to the White House for these kind of meetings unless there has been a lot of work done behind the scenes and up on the Hill and up in various meeting rooms around the White House complex. And I would take this as a hopeful sign. It looks like both Obama and McCain are now sort of semi-obligated to be supportive of what the administration and the Hill arrived with.
Can I ask you this, Carl? We're looking now at the earlier tape on this and where they're seated. I'm sure this is given great consideration. You have John McCain on the far right end or right to the president, and then you have Congressman Boehner, who's the House minority leader. Now, and all the other end there is Barack Obama, and he's next to the woods that looks like Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell.
So, how much thinking goes into where people sit?
Well, a lot. The president's sitting in his customary position on the east side of the table. He is generally flanked by the speaker on the north side or his right, and the majority leader of the Senate on his left or the south side, and then they're opposite numbers in the House and Senate. And typically at that point then, on both the north and the south side, you go to sort of more senior committee chairs or ranking members of the committee that is involved in this. And obviously, rather than putting either Barney Frank or Spencer Baucus from the House or Chris Dodd or Richard Shelby of Alabama, they went ahead and put McCain and Obama. But McCain to the right on the north side of the room and Senator Obama to the left on the south side.
Sorry to subject you to that much Fox Rove news. But now, of course, so he's mentioning the presidential selection, the two main puppets. And, of course, we flip back to Google News right now. Of course, now McCain has he's decided to participate in the debate tonight. John McCain's campaign said Friday morning that he will attend tonight's debate with Senator Barack Obama at the University of Mississippi, reversing his earlier call to postpone the debate so he could grandstand and act like he's not a Keating 5 criminal. The good news is that people don't want this. And that's been the interesting thing. I know I was talking to DJ Cliff a little bit. Guy on before me. In a time of so much overwhelming news, in a way you almost shrink from it. There's no way that I can keep up with all of it. And definitely there's the part of me where it's like, oh, well, you guys are all paying attention to the news now. So that let me have a little bit of a domestic week, and it's my girlfriend's birthday. We had dentist appointments. I did lots of laundry and dishes and vacuuming. And however, fortunately, like I said, people don't want this quote unquote bailout. It's a total fascist power grab from the banksters. Fortunately, people are speaking out. I believe it's been all around the country. I haven't had the chance to look for an update on this, but we're going to listen to a piece out of Minnesota But within this post, there's also a link to where you could find other events around the country where people were going to either some just visible place or their Federal Reserve Bank. Or I believe it started in New York where people were going to Wall Street and such. And we'll get to a little bit more of the protests. However, I believe I saw that there was supposed to be something at the Hawthorne Bridge last night here in Portland. If anybody out there listening in Portland knows anything about that, I don't know if portland.indymedia.org has anything on it. You can hit me up on IMPRA Radio. But let's check out this from WCCO. Thousands have contacted lawmakers about the quote-unquote bailout plan.
We do begin this evening with the bailout plan still being debated by lawmakers in Washington.
Key leaders say they've come to an agreement on what the bailout bill should include, but the White House isn't so optimistic. The Bush administration has agreed to a limit on pay for executives of companies involved in the bailout, but wants to take a look at the details worked out today by lawmakers. President Bush spent his afternoon in a meeting with congressional leaders and presidential candidates Barack Obama and John McCain. But while Congress works feverishly on a bailout plan, there are plenty of folks asking them to reconsider. Here's a live look tonight outside the Federal Reserve Bank here in Minneapolis, where a group of people opposed to the bailout have gathered to voice their opinion. They say giving Wall Street a blank check is not the answer. And it's not just organized protests. The bailout proposal remains extremely unpopular with many Minnesota voters. Esme Murphy has been combing coffee shops and congressional offices for reaction.
In a Minneapolis coffee shop, single mom Ann Pearson thinks the bailout is helping the wrong people.
It's people like me that are having a hard time keeping up the economy and paying their bills, and we're losing our houses and losing our cars, and we need the government to help us and not the bigger people.
On the internet, on blogs, including mine on WCCO.com, the majority of people are saying no to the bailout.
Good morning, Jim Ramstead's office. How may I help you?
Congressional offices are getting bombarded. Congressman Jim Ramstead says he has gotten 1,002 phone calls and emails against the bailout and only 10 in favor.
People are angry. People are angry at the administration's bailout plan. They're angry at rewarding incompetence and bad judgment.
In the past 24 hours, WCCO has contacted every member of the Minnesota congressional delegation. They are all getting these phone calls from the most liberal Democrat to the most conservative Republican. They're getting calls overwhelmingly in opposition to the bailout, putting legislators in a tough spot. A vote for the bailout is essentially a vote against their constituents. But some lawmakers are becoming increasingly convinced that if they don't act, the consequences for ordinary Americans would be devastating. Representative Betty McCollum says she will support a bailout with provisions that help ordinary citizens.
I'm not interested in bailing out Wall Street. I'm interested in making sure that the families I represent don't see their home values decline. They don't watch their 401ks disappear. They don't see their children's opportunity to go to college just go up in the air.
The administration wants the bill passed in a number of days, preferably before Sunday night when the Asian markets open. It's not clear if the details can be worked out that quickly. If you'd like to weigh in on the bailout, just head to Esme's blog. You'll find it at WCCO.com/links. Here's some breakdown of how our economic troubles are trickling down to us. When it comes to credit cards, they don't get you as far these days. Big creditors are now starting to reduce people's spending limits. American Express has cut limits on more than twice as many cardholders this year compared to last. And if your credit is not perfect, you'll probably notice the amount of unsolicited credit card offers in your mailbox are way down.
Thousands contact lawmakers about bailout plan, and that video is available on youtube.com/mediamonarchy. If we jump back just a little bit, and I don't think it's quite so sure now, but something from the AP a day or so ago, deal said to be near in financial bailout. President Bush is bringing presidential candidates Obama and McCain into negotiations on a $700 billion rescue of Wall Street as Democrats and Republicans near agreement on a bailout plan with more protections for taxpayers and new help for distressed homeowners. However, to break it down a little better, let's jump to an article from Paul Joseph Watson. Bush and McCain blackmail America with economic terrorism. From shying away from even mentioning such terms as recession, unemployment, bank failures, Bush, Bernanke, and Paulson are now vigorously invoking the fear of financial meltdown as part of a campaign of economic terror to blackmail the American people into accepting the power-grabbing bailout while John McCain, who last week said the fundamentals of the economy are strong, is now all but threatening to cancel the election should the proposal not receive swift passage. Bush's speech from the White House was a throwback to his March 2003 stump speech before the invasion of Iraq. As we've already noted from the Washington Note, Bush's 9/11 replay just a few minutes ago, remember? Bush's speech was a throwback to his March 2003 stump before the invasion of Iraq. Replace words like weapons of mass destruction with financial panic, and the tone of the two is not dissimilar. Bush rammed home the fear by appealing to people's personal anxieties. Now, someone who knows how to break it down even more, and has been doing it, and has been saying it for, well, I forget, a couple decades, I think, Ron Paul schools Bernanke on the bailout.
We obviously have a serious problem on our hands, and it's the thing that I've been talking about for quite a few years. And earlier on, the senator brought up the subject of the depression, and you did allude to the fact that dislocations and credit creations are a problem and can add fuel to this fire. But at times, I don't think you follow those rules very well. I mean, even though you recognize that's the case, because I think understanding the depression is one of our problems, or the lack of understanding of the depression, because generally most of what people are taught these days is that it was a lack of credit in the 30s that caused the prolongation of the depression. They never talk about the excessive credit and the misallocation and the malinvestment of the 20s that precipitated the bubble that had to be corrected. And then in the depression, what did we try to do? We tried to fix prices, which is exactly what we're doing now. We would not in the depression allow wages to go down, and we said, well, the price of farm products has to stay up. So in doing that, we plowed crops under, and people were starving. And I don't think we've gained a whole lot of wisdom since we were plowing under crops to keep prices up. Because now we're talking about illiquid assets, and we're talking about price fixing. And we're talking about somebody in the government, in the Federal Reserve and Treasury, who does prices. Now, the Austrian School of Economics, which has been around a long time, they predicted the Depression, they predicted the 1970s, the breakdown in Bretton Woods, they predicted all this happening today. Their key point is, don't mess around with prices, because if you do, you become socialistic. And this is why Mises predicted the failure of socialism, and why it did fail. But here we are in price fixing again. You say that part of your mandate is price to but I hardly think price stability comes by price fixing. But the idea of you taking an illiquid asset, for the most part, most illiquid assets are illiquid because they're not worth anything. And if somebody has a house that they bought for $4 million, it goes up to $5 million, he wants to sell and nobody buys it, that's really not an illiquid asset. If he takes it down to $1 million, he might sell it. But people aren't smart enough. The Federal Reserve's not smart enough. Treasury's not smart enough. Congress is not smart enough to know what prices are. So I think that is the greatest danger of what we're doing here is we're price fixing, and that is what I'm convinced that prolonged the depression in the 1930s because we got into that. And this whole idea of credit creation, we've already created $700 billion worth of credit because of the interference and the involvement in the markets ready. And here we're coming along with another $700 billion. The real question is, where is it come from?
That is the question, isn't it? That's Ron Paul giving it to Bernanke. But if we jump to Reuters, China banks told to stop lending to U.S. banks. Chinese regulators have told domestic banks to stop interbank lending to U.S. financial institutions to prevent possible losses during the financial crisis, the South China Morning Post reported with a link for you. The Hong Kong newspaper cited unidentified industry sources as saying the instruction from the China Banking Regulatory Commission, CBRC, applied to interbank lending of all currencies to U.S. banks but not to banks from other countries. The decree appears to be Beijing's first attempt to erect defenses against the deepening U.S. financial meltdown after the mainland's major lenders reported billions of U.S. dollars in exposure to the credit crisis. A spokesman for the CBRC had no immediate comment. China banks told to stop lending to U.S. banks. Now, if we bring it back to the home base again, Our man, Representative Peter DeFazio, spoke for 5 minutes on the House floor yesterday about the quote-unquote bailout.
Chair recognizes the gentleman from Oregon, Mr. DeFazio, for 5 minutes.
I thank the chair.
Well, Secretary Paulson has submitted a simple proposal to Congress. This is it, 3 pages. It's about $1 billion award, and it is quite simple. Secretary Paulson gets the key to the Treasury. You can start off by borrowing $700 billion in the name of the American people, maybe more later. And it waives all laws, no oversight, no one looking over his shoulder, no conflict of interest rules, not even court review. Pretty simple proposal. He insists this has to be done without meaningful discussion or debate or any change by the Congress. Sort of, you know, an immediate authorization for use of financial force. Does this remind anybody of anything like the rush into Iraq on election eve a number of years ago? It's all too familiar. He wants to take care of Wall Street's illiquid assets, is what he nicely labels them. Less charitable pundits have said cash for trash. Wall Street could then return to business as usual. That is Mr. Paulson's plan. He is of, by, for, and about Wall Street, former head of Goldman Sachs. He wants to go back to the way things were. They should never go back to the way things were. There need to be consequences, and there needs to be major change in the financial structures and the financial instrument and the regulation of Wall Street, something this administration still continues to deny or says, oh, we'll do it later after we give them everything they want up front, after we bail them out. Now, many want a condition. What'll happen here? They want to have oversight. That's good. They want to limit executive compensation for a firm that takes the bailout. That's good. They want a linkage to a Main Street stimulus package and jobs. That's good. Those are all good. But we've got to question and take our time here to question the basic premise. Should we just take all their junk, the people like Hank Paulson created exotic instruments, the big party they've been throwing, should we just take that and give it to the taxpayers and borrow the money from who knows where? Or should we take an equity stake in these firms? That's what the government did when it bailed out Chrysler. It said, okay, we'll bail you out, but we own you. And when you come back, we're going to make money for the taxpayer. Secretary Paulson wants to set it up so that the taxpayers, at best, in all likelihood, this wouldn't happen, might break even someday. No, we need to take an equity assurance in these firms, or we need to extend them loans. Have them mark down this junk to market. There's a market for it. It's about 22 cents on the dollar. Make them mark it down. And then if they're threatened and they're illiquid, they can come to us and ask for a loan. And the terms are going to be stiff. And we aren't going to give it to just any one of these firms. No, we need to do this. We need to do it with oversight. And executive compensation is key no matter which way we go. Oh, let the boards of directors control. Come on. Boards of directors are all like first cousins and closer. You know, these people are all feathering each other's nest. Hank Paulson himself got a $50 million bonus for 1 year. The same year, Wall Street rewarded itself with $60 billion in bonuses. That's not a mistake. $1 billion in bonuses in 2006. These people are out of control. They don't understand the real world. And for them to talk about Main Street, pretend they're populist and they care about Main Street and student loans and homeowners equity is a bunch of BS. We need major structural reform. And we are the last bulwark here, the House of Representatives, the United States Senate. Because if we pass this bill, as they proposed it, we will be doing an incredible disservice to the American people, to the world economy. And what if his bet doesn't work? Yeah, the execs come out whole, and they scoot that money offshore into hidey holes or into gold or something else. But what if it doesn't work? And we've extended our credit about as far as we'll go. Where are we going to borrow $700 billion? What's the next step? We need a much more targeted, deliberative approach. Congress can't come up with it in 3 days or 4 days. We shouldn't be rushed into this. If it takes a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, the world will wait. They'll wait for a thoughtful plan that cures the disease in addition to getting us beyond this initial problem. That's the job of this Congress. We should not be rolled by our Wall Street exec who's masquerading as Secretary of the Treasury. You'll back the balance of my vote.
Oregon Rep. Peter DeFazio speaking out against the rush into the BS bailout. Wonder if anyone's ever said BS on the floor of the House before. And I think the last time we've heard from DeFazio on Media Monarchy was when last year he was speaking out and trying to look into the classified portions of Presidential Decision Directive 51, PDD 51, the thing, you know, that pretty much took Congress out of continuity of government. And they said, no, you can't see it. He said, but I'm in Congress. No, you can't see it. He said, but I'm on the Homeland Security. No, you can't see it. But I digress. And if we glance again back at the latest news, this from about an hour ago from the AP Chicago Tribune. Congress restarts troubled bailout talks. President Bush told Congress Friday it must rise to the occasion and pass legislation bailing out the struggling financial system, and leading lawmakers arranged to resume difficult negotiations. But if we jump back to MediaMonarchy.com, this from Wikinews. And this could be good news, or it could just be the people that get out in front and make sure they maintain the cover-up. CYA, damage control. FBI begins widespread financial probe of 26 firms. The FBI is investigating 26 firms and 1,400 individuals involved in the U.S. financial crisis for fraud and subprime lending practices. Freddie Mac, Lehman Brothers, Fannie Mae, and AIG are among the firms being scrutinized after recently receiving federal bailouts. Investigators who are cooperating with the IRS, Postal Office, and other federal offices to complete their investigation are concerned that major corporations may have also forced or bribed ratings agencies to favor them. The probe, which is in its early stages, began 8 months ago when the FBI began taking a close look at the mortgage industry and widespread irresponsible loaning practices. At least one corporation has been raided, but so far no evidence of fraud has been found. And like all these stories, there's lots of links in there to Raw Story and The Guardian and others. But if we move to Alternet, citizens dumping personal junk on Wall Street to protest bailout. And so this is what I'd mentioned. This sort of references the thousands of people contacting lawmakers about the bailout. An email that began as a rallying cry from a lone journalist to an influential circle of friends to protest the U.S. government bailout of Wall Street has ignited a national day of street protests. And you can link to truemajority.wiredforchange.com. For more on that, some demonstrators plan to dump their rubbish in front of the bronze bull sculpture near Wall Street in downtown Manhattan Thursday. People are going to bring their own personal junk that they think is worth as much as the junk financial instruments that the government is proposing to buy from the Wall Street banks, says Andrew Boyd, an activist and freelance online video artist for nonprofit groups in Manhattan. We're hoping that people show up with their 8-track cassette collections, their old Spice Girls CDs, their surfboards that got bitten by sharks, and old Enron stock certificates. So again, I'll have to keep an eye out for any of the updates, and we'll see if protests perhaps grow over this weekend. But if we move to Scoop out of New Zealand, scoop.co.nz, meltdown perpetrators position themselves. And again, like I said, the people who cause the problems come out and act like your savior. Well, they finally did it. The Money Party exposed the nauseating underbelly of first world finance. It's a cross between a Ponzi scheme and a complete math puzzle, all geared to let those in charge rake off as much money as they can, whenever they can, and while they leave us out in the cold. Unfortunately, this time their greed and lack of control has the world poised for a systemic economic meltdown. The collapse and subsequent government rescue of home mortgage giants Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, stock brokerage Merrill Lynch, investment bank Bear Stearns, and an insurance company, AIG, are designed to show we're moving away from the brink of disaster to a safer place. The system is working to manage what Alan Greenspan is calling a once-in-a-century event. And again, he would know. Posted up on the rest of this, money shit, bailouts, banksters, bread, and circuses. There's a lot of other links and interesting stories. We've got this from the DPA, Obama, calling for help for U.S. financial crisis needed from abroad. We've got the Wall Street Journal, and they're not the only place, calling it basically what it is. It's a new world order. So this is the Wall Street Journal's headline of an article. 1 week later, a new world order. The industrials had their biggest two-day rally since 1929. If that's ominous enough for you, that's from Big Picture blog. China blames Wall Street meltdown on Fed overissuance of currency. We've got Christopher Dodd saying the U.S. may be days away from a complete meltdown of our financial system. That's from the Associated Press. Also, an interesting link up to FDIC.gov, and you can look at the failed bank list growing by the day. We only have days to stop the $700 billion stick-up fascist power grab. That's from George Washington. blogspot.com. Regulators shut down Ameribank in West Virginia. That's from the Associated Press. A couple articles about tent cities. In hard times, tent cities rise across the country. That's from the Associated Press and CNN. Growing tent cities blamed on foreclosure crisis. Reuters, of course, having the original story about U.S. Treasury proposing $700 billion bailout plan. We've got an interesting video called the mother of all frauds. Markets remaining on edge as investors seek safety. Fury at $2.5 billion bonus for Lehman Brothers. That's from the Times Online. We've got Ron Paul on CNN with Wolf Blitzer talking about the bailout. The end of America as you knew it is at hand. That's from housingpanic.blogspot.com. Few limits proposed for Treasury from the Wall Street Journal. Conflict of interest. Report says Goldman Sachs among biggest beneficiaries of Paulson's bailout. Of course, again, the gangsters, they benefit from it. Goldman and Morgan to become bank holders and more for you to learn about what a bank holding company is. Financial crisis comparable to terrorism. Alistair Darling tells a Labor Party conference. That's from The Telegraph. Financial weapons of mass destruction from Alternet. China urging new currency order after financial tsunami. That's from Reuters, calling for a new currency. Could it be the Amero? And again, Paulson's firm, former firm, to be among largest beneficiaries of the bailout. New international economic order, America versus the financial elite. And we've got Warren Buffett making a deal with Goldman, of course, and seeing it as a sign of confidence. That's from the New York Times. And then finally, from Bloomberg, Warren Buffett calls crisis an economic Pearl Harbor. To which I have to add that Pearl Harbor, meaning we knew about it in advance, we hastened its arrival, and we will use the shock as a means for more command and control. Problem, reaction, solution. If we move to the next bit, Bush's bankster bailout, bullshit, and more. With a record amount of posting titles on MediaMonarchy.com with curse words in them. This from the Associated Press. President Bush on Wednesday warned Americans and lawmakers reluctant to pass a historic financial rescue plan that failing to act fast risks wiping out retirement savings, rising foreclosures, lost jobs, closed business, and a, quote, long and painful recession. And Bush, of course, beat the fear drums as he was asking for Barry and McCain to come visit him in the White House and, again, act like they run something.
Good evening. This is an extraordinary period for America's economy. Over the past few weeks, many Americans have felt anxiety about their finances and their future. I understand their worry and their frustration. We've seen triple-digit swings in the stock market. Major financial institutions have teetered on the edge of collapse, and some have failed. As uncertainty has grown, many banks have restricted lending. Credit markets have frozen, and families and businesses have found it harder to borrow money. We are in the midst of a serious financial crisis, and the federal government is responding with decisive action. We boosted confidence in money market mutual funds and acted to prevent major investors from intentionally driving down stocks for their own personal gain. Most importantly, my administration is working with Congress to address the root cause behind much of the instability in our markets. Financial assets related to home mortgages have lost value during the housing decline, and the banks holding these assets have restricted credit. As a result, our entire economy is in danger. So So I propose that the federal government reduce the risk posed by these troubled assets and supply urgently needed money so banks and other financial institutions can avoid collapse and resume lending. This rescue effort is not aimed at preserving any individual company or industry. It is aimed at preserving America's overall economy. It will help American consumers and businesses get credit to meet their daily needs and create jobs. And it will help send a signal to markets around the world that America's financial system is back on track. I know many Americans have questions tonight. How did we reach this point in our economy? How will the solution I propose work? And what does this mean for your financial future? These are good questions, and they deserve clear answers.
That he can't give us. Now, I've often said, as we've listened to great clips from The Onion and other satire, that comedy and satire has a way, if it's well done, can cut to the heart of matter. However, here's a disturbing one, and this comes from The Daily Show. Now, it's a long, like, 7-minute clip, but I've cut to the chase, where basically in the beginning of the clip they talk about Paulson and that he basically wants to be a financial dictator and that he should maybe just kind of wear a cape. But they bring on another guy. They bring on one of their, of course, you know, correspondents. So this is from Raw Replay. The Daily Show's Jon Stewart and John Oliver report on the looming financial crisis and proposed bailout plan. But the interesting part, again, is the punchline, and we'll talk about the meme that this represents.
For more on this, return to senior analyst John Oliver. John, thanks very much for joining us. This is a stunning, stunning display. For this administration, after Katrina, after Iraq,
Guantanamo Bay.
Yes, that also put us in a difficult situation. Yeah.
How about the politicization of our nation's judicial system?
Yes, upsetting.
Yeah. The draconian secrecy.
Yes, okay. My point is this. I didn't think there was another area that these guys could screw up.
Oh, no. And it wasn't easy. It was like finding a vein on a failure junkie.
So, is this... I understand that's... Once the veins collapse, it's difficult.
It's very hard.
Is this economic crisis then sort of the turd icing on this administration's cake, if you will?
Okay, two things. One, that was classy. And two, don't count them out, John. It's a long way to January.
So you think there's more out there. What is left for them to decomplish, if you will?
Well, let's see. Do you still have a home?
Yes.
Well, there you go. Did your children have breakfast this morning?
They did. They had a good breakfast.
Was it something they found in the street?
No, it was not. Right, but you're saying the president here won't be satisfied until American children are eating roadkill.
Well, until they're fighting over roadkill. Until roadkill is the prize for the strongest American children.
But why?
Legacy, John. Look, we all know he'll never be ranked as the best president, but he could still, if he works hard enough,
be the worst.
The last.
So there's the joke about Bush being the last president. And so there's the meme. Again, we noted John McCain, on the one hand, not only threatening to not debate, but also in some way almost seemingly to threaten the economic and political terrorism, the idea of calling off the elections. And we've heard said, perhaps you haven't, there are some that have said, as they've of course moved all their assets out of the States and bought property in Dubai, that they've basically said in one way or another that the U.S. won't be here. So, and we're going to get into the election and vote fraud in just a little bit. But that's as we talk about which, you know, Tweedledum, Tweedledum, Tweedledee we want. We just got to make it to the election in the first place. And again, with the way things are going, and all the signing statements and executive decisions and executive orders that have set up at the drop of a hat, if Bush declares a state of national emergency, he would have the power to postpone the elections. It's all in there, and it's all only the smidge that we know about on there, whether it's continuity of government or whether they call it their continuity of operations program. So, an interesting sidebar to this, and again, coming from Raw Replay, there was a protest staged at the National Archives. Arrest Bush and Cheney banner was unfurled at the National Archives. Anti-war protesters hung a banner at the National Archives calling for the arrest of Bush and Cheney. The 22-foot-long banner in red, white, and black read, "Defend our Constitution, arrest Bush and Cheney, war criminals." The protesters, perched on a ledge at the historic building in Washington, D.C., additionally claimed to be on a hunger strike. According to a press release with a link for you, the five are military combat veterans from the anti-war group Veterans for Peace who intend to stay on the ledge and fast for a full day in remembrance of those who have perished and those still suffering from the crimes of the Bush administration. An archive spokesperson had no comment when asked if authorities were planning to take actions to stop the peaceful protest.
Brother, please tell me who you are.
My name's Tyler Kautz.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a veteran. I'm with Veterans for Peace.
Uh-huh. Where did you serve?
I served 1959 to 1962 U.S. Army Airborne.
Right. And why are you out here with your brothers and sisters risking life and limb?
Well, we're here because, A, we would like to see the Constitution restored. And B, and maybe more importantly, we want to see justice and accountability in this country. And if we don't have justice and accountability, we have nothing. Because it sets what's happened with the Bush administration has set a terrible precedent for any future administration. So if justice is not served, Bush has committed war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the entire administration has, including members of Congress who knew about torture and did nothing, and continued to fund, not only that, continued to fund the war. You know, and they had their opportunity, rectified it. Constitution enjoins impeachment in a case like this, which they did not do. And we have followed every avenue, every peaceful, lawful avenue to address this. We have petitioned Congress. We have met with John Conyers personally. We have had numerous meetings with John Conyers as veterans, you know, begging him to implement the Constitution. You know, there's never been a more thorough case for impeachment. So now that we realize that the Congress will not impeach, we're demanding prosecution. And we love what Vincent Pugliosi has written in his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. I encourage everybody to read it.
Right.
And he's serious.
Right.
He's not joking around.
Right.
This is a serious man. This is a man who has never lost a case. And he said himself, I don't have time for frivolous pursuits. If I didn't think I had a rock-solid legal case,
right,
I wouldn't even bring this up.
So is this about vindictiveness, brother, or is this
Absolutely.
Really about protecting the Constitution?
Vindictiveness doesn't play a role. We don't care about vindictive. We don't care about punishment. We want justice because without justice, you have no rule of law. You have no country. You might as well have a king. You might as well have an emperor.
Uh-huh.
So it's not a question of punishing anyone. It's a question of establishing the rule of law, establishing justice, restoring a constitution, restoring the basic principles of our country.
The banner and you have spoken centrally to the Constitution. Do you truly believe that from a historic perspective it's in trouble?
Oh, it doesn't exist anymore at this point.
You're serious?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
I mean, Bush has signing statements. You know, if he doesn't like a law that Congress passed, it's no longer the balance of power. It's no longer where Congress... Congress has an equal role where Congress makes the laws, because Congress can make laws and he doesn't have to obey them. There were subpoenas for Karl Rove, for Harriet Myers, for people in the administration. They just disregarded them like they were nothing, like they meant nothing.
Right.
So what is a Congress meaning? It's a paper Congress. It means it has nothing. You know, so we want to restore Congress's rightful role. And this is what this is all part of.
So,
and we got to do it, and people have to demand it.
So now that that this action is occurring this morning, can our fellow citizens sit back and feel that things are now going to be right?
You know, unfortunately, when you have an election year like this, everybody gets excited, and they think that it will all work out. The new president will make things better. But we have a country to redeem. We have a constitution to redeem, and I don't think people can relax. This is one step. This is a message that we want to get out in the public. And you know, it's interesting. These guys who are working here, these guys, I don't think they're here right now.
Uh-huh.
But there's some workers here cleaning up.
Yeah.
They loved it.
Right.
You know, they give me the thumbs up.
Right.
You know, it's great.
Yep.
So, no, we can't relax.
I think they need your attention.
Okay. So.
That video is from Raw Replay, and you can watch that whole thing. One last thing on the post of Bush, Bankster, Bailout, Bullshit. CharlieHipHop.com left a comment that said if they were honest, they'd just admit that we're bankrupt. The bailout is just a stalling tactic to throw this mess, which will only be made bigger by the bailout, into Obama's lap. Now, it's of course, as the vet protester was just saying, we like to think that everything's going to be okay. We just get a new president on, everything will be okay. And as he's even said, of course, looking like it will be Obama. But God knows what the hell's going to happen. Again, it's still a long way, even though we're about 40 days away. 40 days away from the election. That Obama or McCain will be happy to have the powers of all the great presidential decision directives and executive orders that George Bush has issued. And of course, they will make no effort to investigate past crimes. Everybody will get a pardon, free pass, pat on the back. Birdcage liner gets removed, and the agenda rolls forward. Collateral News episode 60 is up on collateralnews.tv, as well as youtube.com/collateralnews. Wall Street bailout. What was that, the Rubicon way back there? Now that their Wall Street scheming has threatened to bankrupt them, the big investment houses have come crying to Congress to bail them out to the tune of untold trillions of dollars of your money.
13 months ago, the subprime mortgage crisis burst into public consciousness. Now, a more comprehensive crisis is consuming some of Wall Street's most venerable firms. If you're still wondering how crisis affects you, it's a good time to start paying closer attention. Welcome to Cloud. Last week, the Dow Jones was a jittery mess after Lehman Brothers collapsed and Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch. Since that time, AIG, a huge insurance and investment services company, was bailed out by the Federal Reserve. And it basically took the printing of money, the printing of about $40 billion to do it. Now, the Fed is just about out of bullets, and there are plenty of other companies that are fucked up just as badly.
There's no question about it. Wall Street got drunk.
When the Fed does something this reckless, financial stocks come under enormous pressure, and in time, the stock market is driven way down. But the real problem for ordinary people is the economic downturn that's sure to follow if credit markets stay frozen and businesses can't stay liquid. Now, we've been experiencing a slow-motion economic collapse for several years now, but the response so far to this crisis makes it all the more likely that that more general economic crisis is just around the corner, and with it, perhaps, a political crisis. But not all crises are bad, because out of them, some good change can come. Let's make a couple of things clear. First off, the major media are not adequately explaining what's happening here. They pretty much treat this crisis as something that, you know, just happened. But that's bullshit. What's happening now is the foreseeable consequence of repealing the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999, which was presided over by Bill Clinton and his then Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin. Rubin also happens to be one of Barack Obama's main economic advisors. McCain is even worse for this crisis. His former advisor and close friend, Bill Graham, played cheerleader for deregulation as much as anyone did on Capitol Hill. Glass-Steagall was passed during the Depression in 1933 to ensure that speculative banking submit to significant regulation. But in repealing it, the government basically ensured that a blind eye would be turned to this latest round of financial larceny. Second, the government has clearly sided with the bad guys in this crisis. Big bailouts, even if they bankrupt the nation, are the payoff for allowing Washington to become corporate-occupied territory. The government could have and should have let these companies fail and forced them to mark-to-market their current assets. But these companies are not being forced to do so. The government, in engineering the bailout, is doing the worst possible thing. It's assuming the risk of these bad bets and trying to keep the game going a while longer. It's economically insane.
The question is how long will it sober up and not try to do all these fancy financial instruments?
One way of putting the magnitude of this crime into perspective is this. For about the last 20 years or so, your government's been telling you that there isn't any money to even begin a national health care program for the 40 million or so people with no health care. But somehow, the minute the big mortgage houses and a few investment banks go tits up, there are trillions of dollars to bail them out. You need surgery you can't pay for, and you can rot for all your government care. But AIG? No, they have to be saved, even if it takes printing money to do it. Do you get the picture? Michael Hudson, the economist from whom much of this analysis has been drawn, has said it best. The class war is back in business with a vengeance. Corporations have fought Washington, and now they're getting the payoff. It has to be stopped. See, the biggest distortion here is that you have to save all these big companies or else the global economy will crash. It's bullshit. If Fannie and Freddie and all the big investment houses fail, the fake economy would crash, and that would cause much pain in the real economy for a while. But if mortgages were recalibrated to the actual value of the homes they're tied to, and if a new regime of financial regulation were imposed by Washington, we could come out of it. But the bailouts here are designed to keep the current fiction alive by paying off these companies on the overinflated loans that were taken and bundled, and thus by letting the fake accounting go on. This, in turn, ensures that long-term pain is coming, and the little people are going to feel it a lot more than the giants will. We're being robbed. And while you could argue that we're getting what we deserve for letting these criminals run amok for so long, there's no reason that the people should have to foot the entire bill. Everyone on Wall Street should be made to come clean. Open your books. See who's broke. If you're going to have market capitalism, then regulation is the only way to maintain integrity. In a true democracy, where special interests don't dominate the public interest, that would be obvious. Good to see you next.
That was episode 60 of Collateral News, Wall Street Bailout. Was that the Rubicon way back there? I believe it was. And so we're just about done here with all the financial crumbling news. But as I take one glance back at my personalized Google News page with some of the latest stuff coming from Ron Paul, the guy that basically can say, I told you so. This is from New TV. Ron Paul has been enjoying the rare opportunity to gloat, because it turns out that their man called the economic collapse a year ago. Also up on Zeal for Truth, Ron Paul is right and always has been right about the economy. I believe he's also going to be on Anti-War Radio with Scott Horton today. And also, most interestingly, perhaps, from Gather.com, Ron Paul says Greenspan and Bernanke should be criminally charged. Congressman Ron Paul says that the bailout bill is likely to pass, heralding a 10-year-plus economic depression for America and the potential for martial law should civil unrest arise as the financial meltdown worsens. So there you go, my friends. And so if we scroll down a bit on MediaMonarchy.com for the last bit of financial news, this coming from last Monday, September 22nd, oil posts biggest gain ever, as bailout power grab looms. That second part's, I added that. But from Bloomberg, crude oil climbed more than $25 a barrel on Monday, September 22nd, the biggest gain ever as traders scrambled to unwind their positions on the October
contract. We interrupt this program with a special bulletin. America is now under martial law. All constitutional rights have been suspended. Stay in your home. Do not attempt to contact loved ones, insurance agents, or attorneys. Shut up. Shut up. Do not attempt to think or depression may occur. Stay in your home. Curfew is at 7 p.m. after work.
Message from our sponsors. A very timely message, I might add. And I should tell you now we're well into hour number two of episode 93 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. It's September 26th, 2008, coming to you live every Friday from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7, revereradionetwork.com. Also on KBFR in Boulder and Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta. And, of course, MySpace, Dig, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, and Skype with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And, of course, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org for the podcast, which, as I said at the top, there's basically two shows a week now because there's so much going on. I can't cram it all into a two-hour show on Fridays. I've been doing a B-side early in the week, Monday or Tuesday. So you got to hit up the subscription fee to make sure you get those, because you're not going to hear it on the Portland Radio Authority or on Revere. So anyway, now that I got that out of the way. And as I mentioned earlier, we're looking at all these things going on, we get all excited, and then we remember, oh, that's right, our elections are fucked up. So the first posting I have, electronic voting problems for Maryland and Florida. First, ABC's David Wright reported that voters in Maryland have concerns about the voting process. There's also an article linked up from Howard University out of D.C., thehilltoponline.com, New voting glitches raise concerns in Florida. This from MSNBC. Nearly a month after voters in Florida cast their ballots, opponents in the razor-close election head for court as a judge approves a third recount. Sound familiar? Welcome back to Palm Beach County, where the more things change, the more they stay the same. With 41 days to go before the presidential election, election officials and political operatives in this heavily populated Florida county, famous for overvotes, undervotes, butterfly ballots, and hanging chads, are worried about a repeat performance of the chaos that clouded the outcome of the 2000 presidential race. If we jump to another posting, this going all the way back to last Friday, September 19th, this from Raw Story and CNN. 10 swing states have voting problems. CNN's Kitty Pilgrim reports on a study from Common Cause that says 10 swing states have voting problems. And there's links there for more on the report, as well as a PDF of the Common Cause report. And then finally, the Washington Post. Going back to the 17th, high turnout and new procedures may mean an election day mess. Faced with a surge in voter registrations leading up to November 4th, election officials across the country are bracing for long lines, equipment failures, and confusion over polling procedures that could cost thousands the chance to cast a ballot. The crush of voters will strain a system already in the midst of transformation, with jurisdictions introducing new machines and rules to avoid the catastrophe of the deadlocked 2000 election and the lingering controversy over the 2004 outcome. Even within the past few months, cities and counties have revamped their processes. 9 million voters, including many in the battleground states of Ohio, Florida, and Colorado, will use equipment that has changed since March. But the widespread changes meant to reassure the public have also increased the potential for trouble.
And welcome back to Tampa, Florida, day two of our nationwide tour of some of this country's battleground states. Do you remember back in the year 2000 when everybody in this country watched and waited to find out who the next president would be after the election meltdown here in Florida? Could it happen again? Well, NBC's Kerry Sanders covered that race for us 8 years ago, and he's covering this one for us as well. Hey, Kerry, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. Remember these, the old punch card, the troubled punch card? Right. Well, they're gone. Florida spent $153 million to improve the system. So are there problems? You betcha. And where else? In Palm Beach County, where there is chaos again.
It all looks and sounds a little bit like 2000.
This appears to not have a vote in this race. It would be an undervote.
The issue now,
I don't think it's going to be able to discern voter intent on this one,
is the same as 8 years ago.
The law is clear. You should let every vote count.
Optical scan ballots replaced the problematic punch cards. Dimpled and hanging chads be gone. But the race for circuit court judge here reveals new problems. An optical scan is supposed to be simple. Voters connect the arrow on their candidate. What they often do, X's, check marks, boxes, stars, dots.
In one case, at least, they actually kissed the ballot with lipstick. My mission in life is to keep the late-night comics from having any new material. Trust me.
That may take some doing. In the race for Palm Beach Circuit Judge, initially there was a 17-vote difference. When they recounted by computer and by hand, there was a 60-vote difference, a different winner, but 3,500 ballots were missing. That triggered another recount, which mysteriously turned up another 159 ballots. No winner yet. The one unanimous vote, distrust.
This is insanity. Total insanity.
The lawyers doing battle in this local race may look familiar. He represented Bush, and he represented Gore back in 2000. Could this local ballot battle be a grim prelude to another close race?
Is there comedy to any of this?
It is, unfortunately, could be tragic in terms of electing a president of the United States.
My favorite, of course, that voter who kissed the ballot. Where's this race going to be solved? Well, looks like it's going to be resolved in court. And where have we seen that before, Matt?
Yeah, we've heard a lot about that. But Governor Christie thinks things are going to go better in the general election. I was going to say.
Not too much.
Bad luck. Kerry Sanders. Kerry, thanks very much.
Thank you. 8 years ago, all eyes were on Florida as the state was thrust into the spotlight during the hotly contested 2000 presidential election. Now, Democrats and Republicans are signing up to vote in big numbers in the battleground state. So much so that Florida election officials can barely keep up with a crush of applications. Florida Division of Elections has hired 25 temporary workers to process all of the applications pouring into its offices.
We knew as a part of a presidential election there'd be a higher influx, and this is one of our procedures to handle inordinate amounts that come in within a short period of time.
Some temporary employees are working 7 days a week to try to get all the applications processed in time.
We have gotten tubs and tubs of applications from organizations that have had voter registration drives throughout Florida.
Even local election supervisors have been asked to lend a hand with the paperwork, but not all are happy with the request.
Once you get a certain level of influx within a day or two, we will contact the county to give them the option to volunteer to assist with applications and get them back down to the counties if we need to, but that's simply part of our plan.
Several improvements and updates have been made in Florida voting procedures since 2000. At the time, voter fraud was a major concern. But now, Florida has a new no-match, no-vote law requiring numbers on voter applications to match those in the state's database. Mike Gracia, the Associated Press.
Next, we're going to return to the elections. 6 weeks from today, along with our partners at USA Today, we're visiting all 50 states over 50 days. Tonight, we use a visit to Maryland to highlight problems that exist all across the country. What's the best way for people to vote? And how can you be sure the vote count is right? ABC's David Wright is in Baltimore.
This week, in every precinct across Maryland,
you check in the voters using the poll books.
Thousands of election judges, folks known elsewhere as poll workers, are getting a refresher course. Maryland adopted this state-of-the-art system in 2002 after the Florida recount. No hanging chads here. Voters cast their ballots electronically on touchscreen terminals. Yeah. State lawmakers don't trust the new system. They don't like the fact that there's no piece of paper to double-check.
How are the votes counted? Who's counting votes? Who's the Secretary of Elections? All these things that people didn't pay attention to before 2000.
So after November, Maryland will get rid of its fancy new voting terminals and go back to paper ballots.
So you're going to throw all these machines out?
We've not been told yet what's going to happen with these machines.
There are no real national standards for voting. Election procedures are decided state by state. And Maryland, like many states, has had its share of problems. In 2006, voters in many minority precincts had to stand in long lines.
Why is it happening? Why wasn't the machine checked out?
The problem? A shortage of working voting machines and trained election judges.
The lines were so long in the middle of the day that a lot of people just had to give up and couldn't vote. I am concerned that that could happen again in 2008.
Maryland, like many states, is expecting a record turnout, at least 250,000 new voters.
Already ready. For the out people's first Sunday.
At Fadley Seafood in Baltimore, the campaign's a favorite topic at lunch over crab cakes and oysters.
I think you will get more voters going to the polls in this election than any other election.
The voters seem excited, but many told us they have their doubts the process will go smoothly. David Wright, ABC News, Baltimore.
Massive voter registration drives, but a new study by Common Cause and the Century Foundation finds 10 vital swing states have significant voting problems that have not been addressed since the last election. The states with the biggest problems are Florida, Georgia, and Virginia. Colorado follows closely behind. 18,000 people left the polling places without voting in 2006 because computer registration machines crashed, creating long lines. This election day, Colorado will have another brand new registration system.
Colorado is 2 years behind many states in implementing a statewide voter database. This is a new system, and there's just a lot of unknowns as to whether or not voters will be successful.
The problems listed in the report range from not enough voting machines to glitches with electronic registration poll books.
We're seeing a lot of problems where people are being kicked off the database rolls if their name is on as Alex as opposed to Alexander, or they put a middle initial in their name and it's not there. These are problems that are being created by software restrictions that are stringent or glitches in some cases where the program is incorrectly bouncing people off the rolls.
For voters with problems in registration, provisional ballots are provided. Those are paper ballots filled out on the spot and registration is verified later.
There is a very good chance with all the new voters that we're going to see this year that there will be a big demand for the use of provisional ballots, and yet I see nothing except in one of the 10 states that the states are doing to ensure that there will be enough provisional ballots on hand so they don't run out of them.
Voter activists say ideally provisional ballots should be on hand for 10% of the voting population. Kitty Pilgrim, CNN.
So if you decide that you're not going to vote the way that the banksters and the shadow government want you to, If you're not choosing the right pre-selected puppet candidate, we'll just flip your vote. But let's shift gears and move to my man from Portland, Oregon, Alex Ansari, and Outside the Box, alexansari.com, alexansary.com. Episode 170 of his television show, Outside the Box, that runs here on Portland Community Media and is always available up on Google Video. Episode 170 is up with Harley Schlanger of LaRouche Pack. Alex talks with Harley Schlanger about the government bailout of multiple banks and the consequences that could result in the very near future. So that whole hour episode is up. He also posted up an extra video that he shot in downtown Portland, posted up on YouTube, The Walls That Divide Us, a discussion with a local about the different group realities that exist that keep people in our society divided from one another. It comes down to belief systems and the illusion of separation. So not only do we have his latest episodes on We the People Radio Network, WTPRN.com, Alex is now burning the candle at both ends and doing a show on the Oracle Broadcasting Network, oraclebroadcasting.com, and you can get his first few episodes from the 23rd and 24th. They're available, so let's listen to a little bit of Alex Ansari, Outside the Box.
We're here on Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland, Oregon. What's your name?
My name's Casey.
Casey. We just met Casey, and we were having a really interesting conversation, and I've been talking a lot about the walls that divide us, you know, all these little bubbles that we're in. And you have some really interesting, you know, thoughts on that. Here in Oakland, we have something called hipsters.
Yes.
They look really cool, you know, like we're really in the scene. And, you know, you really feel sometimes in Portland that you're actually very disconnected, you know, from people around you. I mean, this is like that city, right?
Yeah.
Mobile. Thank you, man. We got a lot of stuff that still divides us based on, like, how we look, how we talk.
Well, we have subcultures that actually, like, parody subcultures that in the past actually reflected a want towards social change and, you know, rebellion, angst. All these types of things that seem like they've been relegated to, you know, the bargain bin at your local thrift store. And it's it just seems like it's become more of, like, a fashion than an ideology. And I just think that as soon as we start recognizing each other as, like, you know, human beings, first, primarily, stop seeing the ways that we're different and how we're actually the same, and stop, you know, worrying about, like, how many bullet belts you have on around your waist, or, you know, how messy your haircut looks up, like, when you wake up, and actually, like, look at the news and figure out what's going on.
I wonder where this comes from, because, you know, if you look at the divide there, it is sometimes very much based on, like, appearance and lifestyle, the music goes through, you know, like, values on it. And, like, I think of, like, the human species sometimes as being, to a certain degree, like, herding animals. Like, it's hard sometimes for people to, like, walk alone, you know, be themselves.
Exactly.
And not
you want to identify.
So you're not alone, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But when you lose the actual, well, I mean, it just seems like however long it takes, but it's a matter of time before whatever you do, whatever, like, the origin of that actual culture was, it becomes a parody of itself. And right now, we have nothing but parody. We have culture, subculture after subculture after subculture that parodies, like, the original culture in itself.
We have another phone call.
Hi, Alex.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I think that guy in the truck was absolutely 100% appropriate.
But we live in a society, Barrett, where someone talks like that to a person in authority and they're going, they can't do that. That person's an authority figure. You can't do that. You just say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, here are my papers. I understand this is a dangerous world. I will do what you want me to do. Please just don't hurt me. Just, I'm fine. I have nothing to fear, so I have nothing to hide. Here are my papers. And that's how people will view something like that. Why is this guy saying this?
I don't know.
He's within the constitutional right to do that.
He has the primeval protect the woman syndrome or something, but he doesn't realize it. One of his questions, I don't think, I don't know, he was talking about, are these checkpoints on the border, like between Mexico, like, you know, Texas and all the bordering states, like New Mexico, Texas,
yeah,
so on and so forth, all the way up. he was asking, I think, if you were talking about these checkpoints being there. And he was asking, I think, if they're everywhere. I mean, you know, but in between just regular states.
There's going to be more in the next year, for sure.
With
the economic problems and the increasing crime. And people saying the military needs to come in and execute martial law to keep the rapes and the gang violence off the streets. We've already seen this in Arkansas.
Yeah,
so instead of getting to the root cause of the problem and why there's so much crime and why the economy is breaking down, they're reacting with more force, saying this is what we have to do. And we've seen this for decades, and it will increase in the future big time.
They report on the crimes and the violence to make it look like we need to be under control.
Both of those things are happening, Barrett, at the same time. They over-report some sexual predatory activity that's going on, so they build up the fear, specifically the woman's fear of the male, and that's also there to destabilize the relationship between us brothers and sisters to keep people terrified. But at the same time, there's a whole lot of crime and attacks on women that go on even in this city that never make the news. So it's actually kind of like both of those realities coexisting at the same time. Actual crime that doesn't make the news, that people don't talk about, that doesn't get covered, and stuff they use for propaganda to promote their police state.
Breaking it down, as always, Alex Ansari, Outside the Box. We're going to shift gears now and get into a little bit of military corruption. Generals nuked and photos altered. First from Danger Room, and we reported this last week, that there were going to be some wrist slaps connected to all the nuclear heirs, Barksdale, Minot, sending fuses to Taiwan and nukes across the country and falling asleep on the job or whatever it is, you know. DOD names the generals punished for nuke errors. So we just finally got this last Tuesday, I believe. And again, this is from Danger Room. Six generals have been smacked for their involvement in the mishandling of nuclear gear. One got a career-killing letter of reprimand and has requested retirement. The other five will likely be barred from future promotion with letters of admonishment. So let's run down the shit list, shall we? Lieutenant General Kevin J. Sullivan received a letter of reprimand for not adequately addressing logistics policy deficiencies and for not taking adequate action to correct previously identified systemic issues and blah, blah, blah. Lieutenant General Michael A. Hamel received a letter of admonishment for not effectively exercising responsibility for ICBM system sustainment matters within his authority. Major General Roger W. Berg received a letter of admonishment for not exercising effective command oversight of ICBM sustainment-related activities. Major General Kathleen D. Close received a letter of admonishment for not exercising effective command oversight of depot maintenance, engineering activities, and materiel control of sensitive components. Brigadier General Francis M. Bruno received a letter of admonishment for not exercising proper oversight to identify and correct weaknesses in logistics management and maintenance support for ICBM components. And finally, Brigadier General Arthur B. Cameron III received a letter of admonishment for not identifying and correcting deficiencies in depot maintenance operations involving sensitive components. The other bit of military corruption, altered photos. This is coming from the Columbia Journalism Review, CJR.org. Army alters photographs and issues them to the Associated Press. The Associated Press retracted, and there's a nice photo with the AP letterhead. It says photo elimination. It's basically something they send out to all the newspapers saying, The Associated Press retracted two government-issued photographs after a photographer in Texas alerted the agency that the photos in question appeared to be doctored. Bob Owen, chief photographer of the San Antonio Express-News, notified the AP that the photo of two deceased soldiers who died in Iraq on September 14th were nearly identical. Upon examining the photos, Owens noticed that everything, except for the soldier's face, name, and rank, was the same. The most glaring similarity, Owen told CJR, was that the camouflage patterns of the two uniforms were perfectly identical. After inspecting the photographs, the AP confirmed that the images were, indeed, photoshopped, and issued eliminations on the two photos. The elimination reads, "The content of this image has been digitally altered and does not accurately reflect the scene. No other version of the photo is available." The photos were released by the U.S. Army at Fort Stewart in Georgia. And of course, say it with me, officials at the base could not be reached for comment. If we hop across the pond to The Guardian, the UK government is introducing ID cards by stealth. This is up on their editorial section. Comment is free. And I believe this is by Nick Clegg. ID cards for foreign nationals are the thin end of the wedge, whatever they look like, and the Home Secretary who unveiled their design knows it. So that's a little bit of Brit speak, but basically it's a hinky proposition, and even the people who are unveiling it with a link for you for their design, they know it's shady. But here's how it goes. Step one, target a weak group who have no political voice in the UK and who benefit from little public backing or support and make them the guinea pig for a deeply unpopular policy. Step two, once the sacrifice of their rights has embedded as standard procedure, pick off the next target. Airport workers, perhaps, or a group similarly small and likely to fly under the public radar. Step three, involve other public service workers in sensitive positions, followed by next, students. And so it will go until we have all had our privacy surrendered to Labour's surveillance state. This strategy rests on a highly cynical assessment of the British people. At best, it hopes we won't notice when others are having their civil liberties brazenly suspended. At worst, it assumes that our fear of outsiders will allow us to sit idly by as innocent people are forced to hand over personal details to a government database. Bear in mind that these are people already living legally in the UK with the papers to prove it, who have moved here, from outside the EU to study or to be with the person they love. If the aim of this scheme was genuinely to combat illegal immigration and working as ministers profess, there are more sensible solutions. Better exit checks and stricter controls on unscrupulous employers would be far more effective. Imagine that. The government keeps saying ID cards will make us safer. But I doubt that terrorists will be trembling at the prospect of new cards. They're mandatory in Madrid, yet failed to prevent the tragic train bombings in 2004. 311. The key obstacle in catching terror suspects is rarely naming them, but it's more about monitoring them and building up a case for prosecution. Now, of course, there's lots of things I could say about monitoring suspected terrorists, but I won't get into that. I know I'm not going to be able to go over all the news. There's a lot of new 9/11 news, of which I was just alluding to. So we'll have to get to that probably in the B-side. But as we scroll down, we of course have international gangsters puffing out their chests at the UN. And we do have videos and such of that. I don't have the clips for you right now, but Ahmadinejad, Iran's leader. So, okay, let me back up. All the international gangsters were meeting at the Rockefeller land known as the United Nations in New York, but Ahmadinejad says that the American empire is near collapse. Iran's president, this is from the Associated Press, Iran's president accused a, quote, few bullying powers of trying to thwart his country's peaceful nuclear program and declared in a speech Tuesday before the UN General Assembly that the American empire is nearing collapse. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad sharply attacked the United States and NATO, accusing them of acting as aggressors in Iraq and Afghanistan and of starting those wars in order to win votes in elections. American empire in the world is reaching the end of its road, and its next rulers must limit their interference to their own borders, Ahmadinejad said. In a highly rhetorical speech, meaning full of hot rhetoric, the Iranian leader again criticized arch-enemy Israel and showed no sign of reaching out to Western powers at the UN, where the United States and its European allies are seeking a new round of sanctions if no agreement is reached on limiting Iran's nuclear capabilities. Some worry that Israel or the U.S. might resort to military strikes if they believe all diplomatic options have been exhausted. So if we jump from one unpopular leader in Iran, see, and that's the thing. Ahmadinejad isn't popular. We're going to stage some whole coup to get rid of him, even though if we would just let the democratic process play out, he'll be voted out. But if we jump to our own unpopular president, UN needed more urgently than ever, says Bush. And this is from The Guardian. George Bush used his final speech to the UN before stepping down as the U.S. president, we hope, to defend the war on terror and urge other countries to support it. Bush said terrorism was the biggest challenge faced by the UN since its charter was drawn up in 1945. The U.S. president, who ultimately ignored the UN in pressing ahead with the 2003 invasion of Iraq, he forgot that part, said the scale of the threat illustrated that the UN and other multilateral organizations are needed more urgently than ever. In a rebuff to those arguing that the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan had acted as a recruiting tool for extremists, Bush said, quote, "Bringing the terrorists to justice doesn't create terrorism. It's the best way to protect our people." And again, I don't even know how to begin breaking down the bullshit and lies and all that. Because we know, we've reported on it again and again and again, how we provoke reactions. Remember, we just went over Michael Hayden, head of the CIA, talking about how we tickle terrorists, goading them into respond. We also know about, of course, Pentagon's P2OG, the proactive something or other. But basically, we push you until you fight back, and then all we know that, oh, you're the terrorist because you fought back. It's not entrapment or anything. It's not like any other regular person would fight back if thugs from somewhere else were occupying their town. So on a good note, this from the Associated Press, war resistor wins temporary stay in Canada. An American soldier who fled to Canada after learning his unit was being deployed to Iraq won a last-minute stay of deportation September 22nd. Federal court judge Richard Mosley ruled Jeremy Hinsman, H-I-N-Z-M-A-N, Jeremy Hinsman can stay in Canada while the court decides whether he can appeal his deportation order. "We're elated," Hinsman said moments after the decision was released, "but we're not out of the woods at all. We just have a stay of removal." Hinsman, 29, who holds the rank of specialist, was due to be deported today. This being when? Tuesday, September 23rd. So he was due to be deported on the 23rd to the U.S., where he is charged with fleeing to avoid duty in Iraq. He had served a tour in Afghanistan during his 3 years in the Army, but argues the Iraq War is immoral and illegal. And I was about to mention Pat Tillman, and so thereby just invoking his name gives me the segue into the next article related, also from the Associated Press. Soldiers allegedly killed by fellow GI in Iraq. A soldier was detained in Iraq after he allegedly opened fire on a superior and another unit member, killing them both, the Army said last Wednesday. The soldier was subdued by other troops, and medics tried unsuccessfully to save the wounded soldier, said Major General Anthony Kukulo, commanding general at, oh, there it is again, Fort Stewart in southern Georgia, where the soldier's unit is based. An Army spokesman said the shooting happened Sunday in Tunis, Iraq. The slain soldiers and the alleged shooter, whose name was not released, belong to the 4th Brigade Combat Team of the 3rd Infantry Division. The Army identified the slain soldiers as Staff Sergeant Darris J. Dawson, 24, of Pensacola, Florida, and Sergeant Wesley R. Durbin, 26, of Hearst, Texas. Both were assigned to the brigade's 3rd Battalion, 7th Infantry Regiment. We also know the accused is in custody, in control of military authorities in theater for now, and the investigation is underway, Kukulo said in a release that gave few other details. And I always like when they throw out the word theater, of course, calling it exactly what it is. CBS and the Associated Press, with a follow-up of something we've been covering over the last year. And it's all the terrible things in our drinking water. That's all, it's just okay. And again, this is a follow-up, and you can hit the flashback to a couple months ago on MediaMonarchy.com. If you jump back to May, where the EPA said, "Drink refreshing, delicious rocket fuel." The new one from the CBS AP report, EPA won't remove rocket fuel from water. Agency says health risks are low, Critics say EPA is protecting the Pentagon from liability. The EPA has decided there's no need to rid drinking water of a toxic rocket fuel ingredient that has fouled public water supplies around the U.S. EPA reached the conclusion in a draft regulatory document not yet made public, but is under review by the AP. The ingredient perchlorate, P-E-R-C-H-L-O-R-A-T-E, perchlorate, has been found in at least 395 sites in 35 states at levels some scientists say could interfere with thyroid function and pose developmental health risks, particularly for babies and fetuses. The EPA document says that mandating a cleanup level for perchlorate would not result in meaningful opportunity for health risk reduction for persons served by public water systems. The conclusion, which caps years of dispute over the issue, was denounced by Democrats and environmentalists who accused EPA of caving in to pressure from the Pentagon. And of course, I have to mention, the EPA and Christine Todd Whitman came out and said that the air was safe to breathe at Ground Zero. Lies. Complete fucking lies so we could get our banksters back up and running with the bulls on Wall Street. And of course, we're going to have far more people die, first responders, than will have died in the initial attacks. But I digress. As we look abroad again, as we see everything clenching up, seizing up, itchy trigger fingers, everybody getting antsy, nervous, it's a powder keg. The French agency press and others are reporting that Russian warships have set sail for maneuvers near U.S. waters as the squadron heads to Venezuela for war games coming up in November. So a fleet of Russian warships led by a massive missile cruiser set sail from their Arctic base last Monday for naval exercises off Venezuela near U.S. waters that have not been seen since the Cold War. So the nuclear-powered guided missile cruiser Peter the Great, the anti-submarine warship Admiral Chebaninko, and other accompanying ships. So, Russian Navy spokesman said he cannot reveal how many ships were involved in the deployment or when they would arrive. The exercises in the Caribbean Sea are expected to take place in November or December. The deployment follows the arrival of two Russian Tu-160 nuclear bombers in Venezuela earlier this month, also for exercises, an event that Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez branded as a warning to the U.S. empire. Chavez was due in Moscow this week on his third visit since June, saying, quote, "It's a warning. Russia is with us. We are strategic allies. It is a message to the empire. Venezuela is no longer poor and alone," the fiercely anti-U.S. leader said during a public event this month after the bombers had landed.
A fleet of Russian warships led by a guided missile cruiser have set sail from their Arctic base for joint naval exercises off Venezuela near U.S. waters. Russian Navy said the fleet includes the nuclear-powered guided missile cruiser Peter the Great and an anti-submarine warship. The exercises not seen since the Cold War in the Caribbean Sea are expected to take place in November or December. The deployment follows the arrival of two Russian nuclear bombers in Venezuela earlier this month, also for the exercises, an event that Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez branded a warning to the U.S. empire. Chavez was due in Moscow this week on his third visit since June last year.
Coming from the Irish Times, and seeing as we talk about the things that go on and the way we sort of try and predict, but it's not prediction. They write it all down. The think tanks, they put it down, whether it's Project for a New American Century or Operation Northwoods, which proposed painting up planes and shooting them down in order to generate a response from Cuba, which of course Kennedy resisted and of course fired his chief of staff, rather Lemnitzer. But anyway, I digress. It's all in their white papers and in their think tank groups. U.S. generals planning for resource wars and perpetual conflict. The U.S. military sees the next 40 years as continuous war against ideological motivated terrorists and competing with Russia and China for natural resources and markets. As General Ray Odierno takes command of U.S. forces in Baghdad from troop surge architect General David Petraeus, America has begun planning in earnest for its phased withdrawal. The extra brigade combat teams or battle groups deployed to Iraq by Petraeus have already withdrawn, and a further 8,000 troops have been diverted to Afghanistan, where the supposed real terrorists are. As, of course, Barack Obama wants to send us more in there. In January, the next president of the United States will conclude America's timetable for withdrawal and final negotiations with the Iraqi government. Further evidence of America's future military intentions is contained in recently published strategy documents issued by the U.S. military. Under the auspices of the U.S. Department of Defense and Department of the Army, the U.S. military just published a document entitled 2008 Army Modernization Strategy, and you can download the 8-megabyte PDF and read the whole ugly thing, which makes for interesting reading against the current backdrop of deteriorating international fiscal, environmental, energy resource, and security crises. The 2008 Modernization Strategy, written by Lieutenant General Stephen Speaks, Deputy Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, contains the first explicit and official acknowledgement that the U.S. military is dangerously overstretched internationally. It states simply, the Army is engaged in the third longest war in our nation's history, and the GWAT has caused the Army to become out of balance with the demand for forces exceeding the sustainable supply. Against this backdrop, the 90-page document sets out the future of international conflict for the next 30 to 40 years as the U.S. military sees it. And they outline the manner in which the military will sustain its current operations and prepare and transform itself for future persistent warfare. And these are quotes. Transform themselves. Persistent. The document refers to operations in Iraq in the past tense. It implies that operations in Afghanistan may be expanded. It states explicitly that the U.S. military is preparing to fight continuous resource wars for the long haul. The document also describes explicitly the manner in which the Earth's orbit is now deemed a legitimate zone for offensive military activity. This extraordinary document describes U.S. strategic doctrine in terms worthy of 20th century science fiction. The mix of 20th century science fiction and Orwellian perspectives unwittingly continued, or rather contained, in the document appear rapidly to be materializing as fact. And, of course, we mentioned 20th century science fiction and Orwell and H.G. Wells and Aldous Huxley. These guys were all on the inside. They knew what was coming up. They weren't pulling ideas out of their ass. They were telling us what was coming. And so we have the choice, again, the phony choice. Would you like the Orwellian boot on the face of humanity forever? Or would you like the sort of ultimate revolution that Aldous Huxley speaks about, where people learn to love their slavery? You should check out his speech from 1962 at Berkeley, The Ultimate Revolution, where people will love their servitude. And again, Aldous Huxley and his brother, and UNESCO and the UN and Galton and eugenics. But again, I digress. I'm just about out of time, and I'm not going to be able to dive into Pakistan in the crosshairs. We've had the massive bombing at the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad. And of course, there are tons and tons and tons of questions surrounding it. The questionable timing of the Pakistan blast. What the U.S. military was there doing in the Marriott. And even before all that was going on, we have former CIA agent Robert Baer, the guy who Syriana is based on, and the guy who says that most of the evidence points to 9/11 being an inside job. He has an article up saying that Washington is risking war with Pakistan, and of course we've had the newest reports of Pakistan firing on U.S. helicopters. Unknown powder sent to U.S. diplomats in Pakistan, and of course, the late Benazir Bhutto's widower has now been elected as Pakistan's president. a lot of bad things going on, and it's definitely Pakistan in the crosshairs, and we're going to have to get more further into that on the B-side here in a couple days. So lastly, let me just mention that CERN, the end of the world machine, has broken down. All that buildup for the breakdown. This from Press TV, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, CERN, says its particle collider will be shut down due to a helium leak into its tunnel. There has been an accident in a test. One section of the machine will have to be repaired, CERN spokesman James Gillis announced last Saturday. The collider, the largest of its kind in the world, will be taken offline for at least 2 months following a large helium leak due to a fault which occurred last Friday. Preliminary investigations suggest that the most likely cause of the problem was a faulty electrical connection between two magnets, which probably melted at high current, leading to mechanical failure. So again, the update from National Geographic News. Large Hadron Collider shut down until spring 09. So the machine that many feared would create black holes and cause the end of the universe as we know it, it broke down. So we dodged that bullet, but nevertheless, there are many other bullets heading our way. So let's take a quick glance, my friends, at some of the interesting visitors to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. I use StatCounter.com to track the visits. It's always quite interesting to see who and what are searching. So first we had the Oregon Regional Behavioral Services at Columbia Care out of Medford, Oregon. They were reading, of course, about Barry Jennings, key 9/11 eyewitness who mysteriously died a few weeks ago. Abbott Laboratories out of North Chicago were reading about the Bayer pesticide factory explosion in West Virginia. Price Waterhouse out of St. Petersburg, Florida, reading about the Capitol Police arresting the guy with the weapons cache a couple weeks ago. Texas Education Agency out of Austin, reading about the Grayston Lynch obituary that happened a few weeks ago, one of the last, I believe, surviving members of the failed, botched Bay of Pigs fiasco. The whole Bay of Pigs thing. We had our good military-industrial complex private contractor friends at SAIC Googling Topoff 5 and, of course, their conflict of interest and their connections to Topoff 4 in Portland last year. But we also had the Wake County Public Schools in Raleigh, North Carolina. They Googled DARPA's syphilis Tuskegee, Alabama. And I think they're mixing things up. I'm not sure that DARPA had anything to do with the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, you know, where we gave black men syphilis and let them die of it. Again, Bayer, one of the great Nazi companies that we still have. The Bayer Corporation themselves Googled Bayer explosion video. We had the USD Medical School out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hit me up for my link on whatreallyhappened.com. Again, reading about Barry Jennings. Pine Bluff Cable TV out of Pine Bluff, Arkansas. They were reading about how the film Dark Knight reflects real martial law, not only in Chicago where they filmed it, but in America. I think it's quite fitting that that's been the number one movie. I think on its way to beating Titanic. A future where you can't really tell the difference between the cops and the criminals, and of course you justify bringing in the National Guard. So it's all there, and it's America's favorite entertainment. We had the U.S. Department of Transportation out of Alameda Google DOD exercises. NASA, we're reading about way back on MediaMonarchy.com, hired guns in Iraq, killing for amusement. The DOD Network Information Center out of Columbus. Hit me up from a link on Technorati. Again, SAIC. Again, Googling SAIC top-off procurement. The West Virginia Department of Education out of Charleston, West Virginia, Googled Silver Bridge in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Of course, referencing the Silver Bridge collapse and its connections to the Mothman. And finally, we had the American Express Company out of Phoenix, Arizona, visiting MediaMonarchy.com. So there's a lot going on, a lot I didn't get to cover. I can't cover it all. It's starting to get overwhelming, my friends. So as we see our economy collapse, and as we see our two puppet candidates going for a stage debate this evening, we should note that we touched on, I believe, on the B-side, that on October 1st, remember, combat brigades from Northcom will be patrolling American streets. And as we've also heard mentions of September 30th being some mythical supposed time where the Piper's going to call and American debts will finally rise to the surface. So a lot of speculation, a lot of fear, a lot of questions. But like Alex Ansari says, like with all this, the real path to understanding and enlightenment starts within. We can't always be looking to some leader or some other thing or some other group. It starts within. So, my friends, once again, let me thank you for listening to MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. This has been episode 93, coming to you September 26, 2008, from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. I'll be here for you, looking like twice a week now, so make sure you catch the B-side from MediaMonarchy.com. So, like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.